Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 431, recorded on Sunday, June 26, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and joining me on the line, as always, from Boise, Idaho, for this particularly uplifting episode is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
No laughs. Okay.
I'm being professional.
So, this week's topic is about industrial and especially, but not exclusively, electric elevators in the United States. So elevators with manual or animal-drawn pulley systems have existed since ancient times. Obviously, right, it's very useful for, you know, building coliseums and cathedrals and that kind of thing. But widespread production of modern elevators essentially begins with industrial steam power, originally in the mining industry, and then evolves into hydraulic elevators and eventually toward electric power elevators at the end of the 19th century. We're not really focusing today on the, like, really industrial elevators in the sense of, like, the mining industry or a construction site, because, again, there's obviously some crossover there, but some of that is also not exactly what we're talking about here, and it's a older technology that was just being sort of modified. So in a lot of ways, the type of elevators that we're going to be talking about in the second half of the 19th century were closely related to and technologically analogous to streetcars, except that they were serving verticality instead of the horizontality that we talked about that allowed the cities to spread out. So let's talk today about their development in the United States and how they affected American urban life, especially in the biggest American city of all, New York. So experimental tourist and passenger elevators, as opposed to those industrial workplace and cargo elevators that I mentioned, were tinkered with from, say, the 1820s through the 1840s in Europe. But the modern Otis safety elevator, that's from the US of A, that was developed in New York City in 1852, and after some years of experimental public showcases, including a dramatic exhibition at the 1854 World's Fair in New York, where Elisha Otis demonstrated his safety brake by severing the elevator cable with an axe, his elevator was implemented in a practical day-to-day use sense in 1857 at the five-story, high-end, commercial retail E.V. Howitt building in Manhattan. Otis also famously went on to build the elevators for the Eiffel Tower in Paris, and his Otis Elevator Company went on to become one of the gigantic corporations specializing in the field. There are basically only a handful of companies worldwide that dominate the global elevator market today, and five of them, for example, were fined by European Union regulators in 2007 for cartel price-fixing activity. A lot of those are pretty familiar names besides Otis. You get ThyssenKrupp and Kone and Mitsubishi and so forth. At the time of the 2007 punishment, Otis was owned by American defense contractor United Technologies, but they were spun off during the Raytheon merger, along with another company we've covered on the show, Carrier Air Conditioners. Although that's sort of interesting because you don't really think of elevators as having a particularly large defense function, whereas we actually did focus a lot in our air conditioning episode on the defense functions of air conditioning in the production of munitions factories. So, Rachel, could you jump us back in time a little bit?
Yeah, so going back to the 1850s, by the time Otis was showing off his safety elevator, at the World's Fair, the critical need for elevators in New York City to be able to continue building upward had become so obvious that the Cooper Union College's foundation building had already been built back in 1853 with an empty shaft on the expectation that an elevator would be built imminently. So they knew the technology was coming and they were going to be ready for it. Another Otis, Otis Tufts, designed an elevator car with a bench for seating for his patented vertical railway, creating that connection to the streetcar, versus the platform of Elisha Otis's design. Tufts' design graced the Fifth Avenue Hotel. So Otis Tufts was going for more of a luxurious, comfortable car-based design. And Tufts' design graced the Fifth Avenue Hotel. And it was definitely a luxury, like, experience. People dressed up to go on these elevators and just experience the slow-moving elevator moving from floor to floor. It was definitely kind of more of a novelty experience at this time versus then something that was useful for conveying passengers.
The technology of safety elevators didn't actually take off immediately after 1857. And this is perhaps, and this is now speculation for me, due in part to the local economic impact of the Civil War on New York's commercial and financial sectors. And by the end of the next decade, the 1860s, there were still only a few other elevators in the city serving residential or hotel buildings, as Rachel just alluded to. At least that was what I was able to gather. You can look through the notes that we'll put up at arsenalfordemocracy.com and a PDF with this episode. There may have been more than that, but it didn't seem like there were a ton of them, and it certainly wasn't adopted overnight after 1857. However, the big breakthrough comes in 1870. So after 2 years of construction, started in 1868, the Equitable Life Assurance Building in Manhattan opened, which was an office building with 2 stories underground and 7 stories above ground. So that's 9 stories total at the beginning. And the company rented out extra space to other tenants, especially law firms, who jumped at the chance to have their offices in a prime spot in the city, with passenger elevator services making it feasible to have that much office space in one place. Up until this point, employees and clients were uninterested in walking up lengthy staircases to work in or visit offices of high-end firms. The initial 2 hydraulic elevators at the Equitable Life Building were so popular, and the building filled vacancies so quickly, that it became worthwhile to retrofit within just a few years to add 4 more elevators. The hydraulic elevators were a lot faster than steam-powered elevators, and were more desirable for fast-paced corporate office buildings. Hydraulic elevators were also easier to maintain. In the next decade, Equitable Life added electric lighting to the building from power produced on-site in the basement. That's a callback to the episode we did about urban electrification and the process of generating power for that. And they also added a further 4 elevators for 10 total, as well as adding a whole additional 2 floors, so bringing that to 9 above ground, 2 below, 11 total. And so you can see why an elevator would be useful for that. We turn now to an interesting article from March 2nd, 2014, from the Boston Globe Ideas section about how the elevator transformed America. And we're going to reference this piece a few times throughout today's episode, but this is the first time that I wanted to touch on a specific section. They say elevators first arrived, or I would say more accurately proliferated, in America during the 1860s in the lobbies of luxurious hotels, where they served as a plush conveyance that saved the well-heeled traveler the annoyance of climbing stairs. Initially, these steam-powered movable rooms were extravagantly furnished with chandeliers, benches, and carpeting, says Lee Gray, a columnist for Elevator World and an associate professor of architecture at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Passengers were expected to sit down and get comfortable before the operator fired up the new contrivance, which it's a good way of putting that, firing it up, because these would have been steam originally, again, for the power. It was all about luxury, said Gray. It wasn't until the 1870s, when elevators showed up in office buildings, that the technology really started to leave a mark on urban culture. Business owners, stymied by the lack of available space, could look up and see room for growth where there was previously nothing but air. A development that was particularly welcome in New York, where a real estate crunch in Manhattan's business district had, for a time, forced city leaders to consider moving the entire financial sector uptown. That plan came to be seen as unnecessary thanks to the initiative of one Henry Hyde, the founder of a large insurance firm, and we just talked about that, who realized that by installing a pair of elevators in his headquarters, he could make it the tallest building in the city, 7 stories and 130 feet. In doing so, Hyde ushered in a new era. As a writer for Scribner's Magazine put it almost 30 years later, the passenger elevator turned out to be a revolutionary agent that did for modern building what the steam engine had done for transportation.
The 1870s was also a time when elevator door technology was refined significantly, with new patents for safety improvements, such as doors that closed off access to the elevator shaft if a car was not being entered and exited while stopped at a floor. So before this, it was pretty unsafe. You could just basically walk up to the shaft and, at your peril, get up close and personal, even if there wasn't a car at the floor. So those safety improvements definitely helped also increase passenger confidence in the technology. In the 1880s, the Germans, namely Siemens, of course, again, another connection to streetcars, invented electric power elevators. But the American Frank Sprague, whom we also discussed on the on episode 421 from April of this year for his critical inventions in the field of electric streetcars, developed a ton of devices and technologies for electric elevators that made them safer, faster, somewhat more automated, more consolidated within the physical footprint of a building plan, and just generally way better than almost anything out there. And Sprague eventually sold his company to Otis in 1895. So again, just a whole bunch of connections to electric streetcars and how fast like technology was developing and innovating at this time and becoming a lot safer. From a Time article published March 10, 2020, how electric elevators transformed the modern city, which was adapted from Robert Bryce's book, A Question of Power, Electricity, and the Wealth of Nations. Despite the absence of a plaque, despite being overshadowed by a myriad of other taller buildings in Manhattan, the 14-story high Postal Telegraph Building deserves special stature in the history of skyscrapers. It was at 253 Broadway that one of the greatest, but least known inventors in American history, Frank Sprague, deployed the first bank of electric elevators. By doing so, more than perhaps anyone else, Sprague fueled the rise of the vertical city. Today we think nothing of riding in electric elevators, but those machines allowed cities to house more people on less land than ever before. That increased population density has fostered more human interaction and reduced the impact of cities on the environment. The world's cities now contain more than half of the global population, but, as of 2012, cover less than 3% of its land. After figuring out how to use his electric motors to move passengers across the horizon, Sprague focused on moving them skyward. In 1892, he formed the Sprague Electric Elevator Company, and shortly afterward won a contract to install his electric elevators in the Postal Telegraph Building. Sprague had to prove that his elevators were superior to the slow, bulky hydraulic elevators that dominated the market. The deal was dangerously one-sided. If his elevators didn't work as promised, the contract required Sprague to rip them out and replace them, at his cost. 2 years later, when the Postal Telegraph Building was finished, Sprague's elevators worked perfectly. In fact, they operated at speeds comparable to those of modern-day elevators. That speed was key to their success. In cities, we want to travel as fast, or faster, when we travel vertically as we do while traveling across the landscape. People in cities are in a hurry. A New York minute doesn't last very long. In the 1990s, Italian physicist Cesare Marchetti showed that our commuting patterns aren't necessarily determined by distance, but by time. That is, we don't think much about how far we are going, as we do about how long it will take us to get there. Our travel time constraints also apply to vertical transportation. Sprague's electric elevators at the Postal Telegraph Building proved that vertical transportation could be just as fast as traveling by foot on level ground. That was a crucial turning point in the history of skyscrapers. So, moving to another American contributor to the field of electric elevators was Schuyler Wheeler, who filed the first U.S. patent in 1883, a few years after Siemens had created the technology in Germany. Wheeler was a pioneer of the electrical engineering field and an Edison protege, but Wheeler was spread out across such a huge range of electrical inventing projects that elevators were not, as far as we can tell, a big focus for him. So again, just these American inventors were really involved in electrical engineering, both for streetcars and for this elevator technology.
By 1900, interestingly enough, all the safety and operational technologies had actually been invented to allow fully automated elevators that any passenger could safely and correctly use on their own without the aid of a dedicated elevator operator. But this didn't mean this actually happened. And there are a number of factors for this. One is that the technologies hadn't been implemented widely yet on older elevator systems. There were often big lag times in safety upgrades to existing elevators, according to a piece that I read from the Chicago Public Library. Or another is that the public was generally so unwilling to use them alone, or in the case of New York City, they were banned from self-service operation by ordinance for a long time, that elevators remained in widespread employment for nearly half a century more, often very skillfully piloting their passengers up and down quickly and safely. Prior to World War I, elevator operators in the U.S. tended to be men. During both World Wars, young women replaced many of the men as elevator operators, sometimes permanently, especially in retail settings where they could be trained to double in guiding customers to specific floors for merchandise or to promote sales. And this is before you have the automated voices telling you, you know, what's on each level of a department store. You would have a woman physically in the elevator that's not only running it, but saying, hey, why don't you check out such and such a sale we've got going on floor 3. Office buildings also often switched to women operators during the World Wars. In both cases, the women were less well protected by labor laws or prevailing wages, and they were much more exploited with extensive requirements about how to dress and behave.
So going back to some of the technological innovations that were happening at this time, the modern electric traction elevator was developed in its current form by the 1920s, and that's still basically the technology that we use today. And this innovation in elevator technology ushered in the age of the penthouse. Prior to this, the space under the roof of these tall buildings was undesirable and often filled with debris and building materials, and it just wasn't attractive space at all. The penthouse age turned the space into attractive apartments that were rented out for an elevated, pun intended, price. And quoting from a Boston Globe article from March 2nd, 2014, again, how the elevator transformed America, the arrival of the elevator upended more than urban planning. It changed the hierarchy of buildings on the inside as well. Higher floors had once been distant, scrubby spaces occupied by maids and the kind of low-rent tenants who could be expected to climb 6 flights of stairs. The more important people climbed at most 1 or 2 flights, which gave brownstone-style homes, for instance, their high-ceilinged parlor floors. While the arrival of elevators didn't change this right away, the top floor of Henry Hyde's building was occupied by the in-house janitor. The upper reaches of buildings eventually became desirable. The elevator ushered in the end of the garret and the beginning of the penthouse, as lawyers and businessmen came to appreciate the advantages of having beautiful bird's-eye views and respite from the loud noises of the street. Hotel owners, meanwhile, started turning their top-floor rooms into their nicest ones. They could even rent out their roofs for garden parties, where guests could survey the glittering new city, all without doing a bit of work to get there. So the sudden desirability of upper floors of commercial and office buildings with the arrival of elevators caused an explosion in the rents for upper floors, and many buildings often ended up completely ditching ground floor offices or retail in favor of huge waiting area lobbies for elevators. So basically any fancy hotel or office building from that time has these gorgeous lobbies that are just vast with high ceilings, and it basically leads you to a bank of elevators. So that came about during this age of the penthouse. Another iconic symbol of the elevator era was the Empire State Building, which at the time of its building was the tallest skyscraper, 1931, until 1970. And it was equipped with 73 elevators, the largest elevator order to that date. These elevators boasted a respectable speed of 1,200 feet per minute and made the Empire State Building a popular tourist destination.
So let's get back to talking about those operators as we move forward through this period. So the operator union strike in New York in September 1945, just after World War II, despite hindering millions of dollars in economic activity per day, and despite the cooperation of perhaps 1.5 million sympathetic New Yorkers honoring the picket line, I guess critics would say that many of those people weren't necessarily actively sympathetic, but just couldn't be bothered. This strike apparently broke the spell of the elevator operator, and passengers realized they could just do it themselves, which I suppose is the ultimate scabbing. Nominally, that strike did end in a win for the 32B union. They got a 10-year renewal of labor peace following the war and an anti-discrimination policy. the latter is obviously clearly a win. The former, you could make a case, is not that much of a win. And if those are your big wins and you're not getting various other like wages and so forth that you want, hard to necessarily call that a resounding victory. And either way, this essentially merely bought time for building owners and passengers to make the transition away from operators. By the 1950s, automation was a major selling point for Otis elevators, and people generally could safely operate an elevator themselves with ease. And so, of course, by the 1960s, operators are pretty much gone almost everywhere. There had actually also been a similar strike in 1920 after World War I, but that was during the pre-union era for operators. Safety features were not as widespread at that point, and so the strike had been somewhat tactically successful in either forcing people to use the stairs or, unfortunately, ending up with people sustaining gruesome injuries and fatalities trying to operate the elevators without proper training. And the result of that strike was a bunch of fairly quick, although disjointed, agreements between operators and building owners. It wasn't like it was a sectoral agreement across New York. It was a whole bunch of sort of side agreements. The strikers were also willing to settle fairly quickly, too, in that case, because all of those recently trained wartime female operators were easily recallable as strike breakers if needed. The unionization of New York operators under 32B happened in that interim period between those two strikes. There was another strike, actually, in 1934. And so the unionization of the operators under 32B happened in that New Deal LaGuardia era, when the government was acting as a fairly reliable mediator between labor and owners. That was probably the peak of the good times, relatively speaking, if you were an operator. But you can see there was quite a long period between the invention of the automation technology and all the necessary safety technology and the actual widespread, not only implementation, but adoption of that technology, such that people were just operating them on their own without a dedicated operator. Up until that point, the operators often served a pretty similar function to what they would be doing on a streetcar as a streetcar operator. I also wanted to talk about a few of the later technological developments. One thing that I was talking about with Rachel before we recorded is that a lot of this, after the core invention of the safety elevator in the 1850s by Elisha Otis, is sort of iterative. There aren't necessarily that many huge changes. There's obviously significant improvements in safety, but even so, a lot of it is just building on a previous fix, improving something, fixing this, you know, that kind of thing. And there were a few other things that happened later on in the post-war period that are at least worth mentioning, even though, again, they're relatively similar technologies to what has been around since 1900 and arguably since the 1850s. The final big technological leap in elevators came as part of the Third Industrial Revolution in the mid-1980s, when Toshiba in Japan, after 20 years of research and development, used transistor technology to significantly improve smooth, high-speed elevator movements for ultra-tall buildings. Now, I can't totally explain the science of what's happening there, but I will leave a link for listeners if they want to read on their own about what that was and why it mattered. But obviously, it has pretty significant implications for building those super tall skyscrapers, not just the pretty tall skyscrapers. There are also now more complicated computer systems for dispatching elevators efficiently in those super tall, especially 21st century buildings, but also some of those late 90s skyscrapers. And there are also various other kinds of things that are called elevators, but are basically a substantially different technology. These are either sort of maglev-ish elevators or vacuum elevators. Electromagnetic propulsion means that it lacks a cable. That's the same as the vacuum or pneumatic elevators. I wouldn't personally consider those to be a real elevator. Obviously, if they are implemented, they're serving the same function, but I would consider those to be a pretty significantly different technology that's filling the same niche. And ultimately, I would say that if you're talking about a modern elevator, you're talking about one that has a cable. You know, because there's a lot of things that you could call, an elevator if you were being very generous with the terminology. But steel cable strengths in previously various rope cabling and that kind of thing had been a critical factor in the safety, but also the length and speed of an elevator. The steel cable era in particular was a limiting factor on the length of an elevator shaft, which often forced taller buildings to use a landing system, which is also helpful for speed and efficiency so that passengers don't need to wait through every lower floor stop to get to higher floors. But basically, you would get on an elevator, go to the middle of the skyscraper, get off, get on another set of elevators, and go up to the top of the skyscraper rather than taking one continuously the whole way. And a lot of that has to do with some of the technical limiting factors around the materials, like the steel cables. Recently, some of those major elevator companies have been experimenting with and developing new cable materials, such as carbon fiber and so forth.
So going back to that Boston Globe article, How the Elevator Transformed America, advances in elevator technology combined with new steel frame construction methods to push the height limits of buildings higher and higher. In the 1890s, as Bernard recounts in his book, the tallest building in the world was the 20-story Masonic Temple in Chicago. By 1913, when hydraulic elevators had been replaced with much speedier and more efficient electrical ones, it was the 55-story Woolworth Building in New York. Quickly, the modern city assumed its present shape. As Patrick Karajat, the founder of the Elevator Museum in New York, put it, "If we didn't have elevators, we would have a megalopolis, one continuous city, stretching from Philadelphia to Boston, because everything would be 5 or 6 stories tall." Even less appreciated these days than their transformative effects on American cities are the effects that elevators had on Americans themselves when they stepped inside of them. At first, this was a central concern. As late as the 1900s, doctors worried about a nausea-inducing condition known as elevator sickness, caused by the sudden movement of one's organs inside the body when an elevator came to a halting stop. Public health advocates, meanwhile, warned that the shared conveyances would spread disease among neighbors and coworkers. Other worries were psychological. As Bernard points out in his book, the concept of claustrophobia emerged in the psychiatric literature at the same time as the elevator, and the experience of being inside one was listed from the start as a primary instigator of symptoms. Elevators also raised new questions of etiquette. According to Gray, the author of a 2002 book on the early history of elevators, one big issue was whether a man in an elevator ought to remove his hat in the presence of a woman, as he would in someone's home or a restaurant, or keep it on, as he would on a train or a streetcar. The question, says Gray, reflected a basic uncertainty about what the space really was, a mode of transportation or some kind of tiny moving room. That was only one of the peculiar uncertainties that came with riding elevators. Another was that they felt simultaneously public and private, taking people out of the broader world while locking them into a narrow, self-contained one alongside a random assortment of colleagues, neighbors, and strangers. By bringing together people who often only kind of knew each other, elevators created vague expectations of interaction. A smile, a nod, even a bit of small talk to acknowledge that everyone on board lived or worked in the same building. And I would say that those kind of questions of etiquette still kind of live on to this day. If you want to freak people out, you just kind of face the back of the elevator and stand there stonily, not talk to anyone. That can be very unsettling. So it's kind of interesting that there's still these kind of uncertainties of how to interact with people in an elevator.
Yeah, I actually cut the paragraph that followed that just for time purposes, but it goes into the modern research basically concluding that this problem has not gone away, and people's questions of etiquette and just sort of basic uncomfortability in elevators as a sort of brief liminal space interaction that is very informal. And they talk about things like, you know, the elevator pitch moment that people dream of pitching something to the company CEO or whatever, right? Like, these are all these kind of questions about propriety and behavior in elevators. And some people act genuinely very weird and off-putting and you know, inappropriately in elevators, too. That's obviously a very real concern. This has never gone away. It's just been a continuous issue now for basically a century and a half.
Yeah, and it's interesting that this was written before COVID, obviously. And so I think COVID and the pandemic has really kind of heightened the tension of riding in an elevator with a stranger, especially when masking isn't mandated and, like, do you kick them off? Do you step off? Like, that kind of creates a whole new different interaction and set of choices that you have to make. So it's definitely something that brings the public health factor into it. You are in a conveyance with in close quarters with strangers, and that does add a level of tension to it. So another piece of technology, escalators, came after elevators. Elevators preceded working escalators by nearly half a century, as the latter did not come into use until the mid-1890s. Otis Elevator Company quickly got into that business, too, after it was proven. Another company we've discussed, Westinghouse, did too. In general, the elevator and escalator businesses worldwide are dominated by the same small set of big firms, and those big names that we've discussed over and over again put their hats into the ring. There are some other different kinds of elevators as well that are still in wide use. Other countries, especially Germany, got really into using paternoster lifts instead of elevators, but we're ignoring those because our show is focused on the U.S. side. Also, they look kind of terrifying. They're just kind of a series of boxes that move on a track, and you just kind of hop on and hop off, and they look kind of scary, especially because I'm so used to the elevator that has all these redundant safety features. So the fact that you just kind of hop on and then hop off and you're in an open car moving through the floors looks kind of scary.
So what do you think we learned about the role of elevators in the creating the modern American city?
Well, like that quote I said, we would be really sprawling and a megalopolis. Actually, I was thinking, like, would we even be as urbanized as we are? Would there be a megalopolis, or would we just be kind of spread out in a different way if we didn't have the choice to build up? So it's kind of interesting to think about how our cities would be designed if this technology didn't exist. What do you think?
Well, yeah, because there are definitely parts of the country that are post-elevator cities that are very sprawling because they're automobile cities, and that was the decision that was made, was to sprawl out instead of to build up. Because there's obviously quite a lot of costs associated with building up, so you need to have it balance out, basically. There's also all kinds of challenges involved with high rises and skyscrapers that we didn't get into, where you can have a situation where you actually build too much real estate and floor space and then can't find enough tenants to cover the costs that it actually costs to build. That's been a persistent issue, but that's probably material for another episode. I thought it was interesting the way that it sort of, well, I guess it didn't parallel, it perpendicularized with streetcars and had many of the similar roles and functions, although it's obviously substantially different as well, and that it changed the social expectations and things like that. And it certainly changed the like physical and financial characteristics of real estate in these denser urban environments. You know, you talked about things like the penthouse, but also just this idea of like, we don't have the janitors and the maids hanging out at the top anymore, because that's actually the really good real estate that everyone wants with the great views of the city, instead of the ground floor. So there were some interesting changes there. Again, I don't think any of this is necessarily like, wow, what an amazing thing that I never would have thought of. But, you know, it bears going over, I think, and talking about those changes that happened and when they happened, so we can contextually think of them in relation to all these other trends and technologies that we've been discussing on the show.
Yeah, I think that travel time theorem is very important, too, because it did change how far people are willing to travel because they can get there faster. So I think that's another detraction from the megalopolis theory, because if you had to go from Philadelphia to Boston, would you necessarily get there quickly, or would you just be kind of unmotivated to do that and maybe move somewhere else instead?
Right. Well,
and design your city differently.
Something we definitely talked about a lot on the episode about the postal service and how they used to have in the commercial and financial districts multiple mail deliveries a day and huge volumes of mail going back and forth before telephones were installed everywhere, is that why is it that these businesses are trying to group together in the first place, right? Because at least with the residential side, you can make a case, and this is obviously debatable and partly has to do with like American propaganda around this issue, but you can say, you know, with residential, that there are some disadvantages to living in dense housing environments, and it's nice to have a place of your own and a single family, you know, property out in the outlying areas of the suburbs or whatever. Again, debatable point, but you can see why people make the argument. So the question is, why do these commercial businesses, the law firms, the offices, those kind of things, not also spread out? And in some cases, we're not talking about like one giant firm that occupies the whole building. That did happen. But in a lot of cases, we're talking about one big firm owns the building and then leases out the rest of the building to other tenants. Why do these tenants all want to group together on the commercial and business side of things in the same way that it's important to have that density of mail service and everything like that in these dense turn of the last century American cities? And the answer is because they want to work together and do business together. And if they are spread out, I think, like you said, there's some pretty distinct fracturing and atomization that's going to happen on the business side of things, to say nothing of the residential side of things, if everyone is indeed spread out from, say, Boston to Philadelphia or even further, right? Those businesses are not going to interact very much with each other, whereas the businesses that are all densely clustered together, they can, you know, meet up for a business lunch, swing by the office, even have a casual conversation in the elevator that leads to something, a business deal or whatever, right? This is how you have those close interconnections. And that's why even in the big sprawl cities dominated by cars, you still usually see a downtown core or financial district or something like that of those cities where there are at least, they're not necessarily towering skyscrapers, but some pretty significant modest high rises, even in some of those really sprawling cities. And I think that's the basic thing there that would challenge that underlying notion. But again, one of the other things that we pointed out shows that quote about, you know, what if we never had elevators just wasn't. That's not a realistic scenario that could have ever transpired, because that Cooper Union building built the elevator shaft before the safety elevator technology was out there, right? They were like ready to go. We need to have an elevator. We know we're going to need to have an elevator. Somebody's going to come along and have an elevator that works. And in fact, we didn't talk about this. They didn't design the shaft correctly for what elevators ended up looking like. They had to get a custom elevator built specifically to fit in the shaft that they had built because they just tried to guess. But I think it goes to show that it was very clear that this is where things were going to be heading. And a few people at least had that sort of visionary sense to say, okay, this is where it's going, as opposed to some of the city leaders who are panicking and saying, oh, look, we've got to, you know, potentially move the entire financial district of New York to somewhere else. And I guess it's easy to say, you know, that this was an inevitability, but we also talked about some of these other infrastructural issues that affect sort of the urban geography of these cities, especially New York City, the two being the decline of horses in favor of electric streetcars and automobiles, and the rise of container ships and their terminals, right? So with the container ships issue, required significant land to be able to deal with the containers and move them around and so forth. Not, it didn't require the same amount of warehouse space, so that was a difference, but it did have a physical geography component that ended up pushing it out to a different part of the city. So that's, you know, we could have a scenario where elevators come along slightly too late and the New York Financial District moves to somewhere completely new within the New York area, as happened with the port facilities. And we talked about with the issue of horses and basically phasing those out until the technologies came along to obviate the need for horses being constantly everywhere in these cities. One of the biggest crises facing major American cities like New York was horse manure just being produced in truly astronomically prodigious volumes. And the question was where to put all of it. And, you know, they're filling up empty lots and so forth. And that's obviously not a great financial use of those real estate properties and so forth. And so you're trying to figure out, what are we going to do? Are we going to drown in this endless sea of manure that's being produced, or even the carcasses themselves dropping in the streets? And this was a major crisis that affected cities like New York. And they didn't know if there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel and there was a breakthrough. So I guess that's the kind of countervailing case to say, well, you know, who knows if this was actually a knowable thing, that this was going to be a big breakthrough that happened when it did.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't realize, I didn't read that factoid about the Cooper Union building not actually designing their elevator shaft properly. That's a funny side note there.
Yeah, I mean, they just had no idea. They were just, it was purely speculative. So anyway, all right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the show this week to talk about modern elevators with me.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure.